Hello.
And welcome back to another segment of Connecting the Dots here on listener-supported Real Life Radio. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here every day at this time, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. This being Friday, we are here with my good friend, Mr. Stephen Gradonis. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing all right. I actually just woke up.
Did you?
I did. I took off from work today, and I had some personal things I had to do. I had to bring my dad home from the hospital, like we talked about yesterday, not on the radio, but off the air. Okay. And so I just caught up on some sleep, and I just got out of bed a minute ago. How are you doing?
Well, I am doing well. I got about 4 hours of sleep last night for whatever reason. Just sometimes that happens with me. But I'm feeling sparkly, feeling perky, because I get to be on the radio with you and talk about all kinds of interesting things. We're back to Lent now. Yesterday was Joseph's Day. And a solemnity, and so therefore was an opportunity to party a little bit. So I went off and took like a 4 mile walk just because.
I had sushi.
And you had sushi. So that's so great. And back to the grind.
Yes.
Until next Wednesday, which is yet another solemnity.
Yes.
So we get to party again and celebrate the incarnation of God in the womb of Mary, as well as, if you're a nerd and a geek, celebrating the downfall of Barad-dûr and the destruction of Sauron and the liberation of Middle-earth. So, you know, all these good things are coming out. That's what we're about today. But what's going on in your life? Have you seen any good movies lately? You know, I saw a really nice, an interesting review of Cinderella by Father Robert Barron,
who is so awesome.
I love that guy, you know, and he's a really perceptive film critic, among other things. He's very interested. He did a just prescinding from Cinderella for a minute. He did what I thought was just a fantastic look a couple of years back at the Coen Brothers remake of True Grit.
Yes.
That I just thought
one of my favorite films of the last few years.
It's a great movie. You know, when the Coen Brothers are on, and they're often on, their movies are just fantastic. I'm a big fan, speaking of the Coen Brothers, I'm a huge fan of the Hudsucker Proxy. I love that movie so much. It's just one of those movies. There are a few movies where, like, if it comes on, I would just like drop everything and just sit down and watch it, even though I've seen it several times before, because I just love the movie. And the Hudsucker Proxy is one of those. It's their homage to screwball comedies, and jeepers, it's funny. But anyway, Father Barron's look at Cinderella, I thought was really good, and sort of picking up on the Christian subtexts that often inform particularly European fairy tales, because they come out of a culture that was marinated in the gospel for the last, you know, 15 centuries or so, and so I thought that was cool.
Yes, he and I very much agreed on that film. Father Barron is excellent at picking out from cultural artifacts, including movies, what is most of interest from a specifically Christian and Catholic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really write movie reviews in the sense of, you know, offering a total assessment of the film, but he zeroes in like a laser beam on what is most of interest from a Christian and specifically Catholic point of view. I've only seen him critique a film once. For the most part, he's very positive because he's focusing on that element of interest to Catholics. He did go negative on Exodus, Gods and Kings. That's the only time that I can remember him saying, you know, this movie really basically missed the boat.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, of course, one of the things that he observed in his review of 2012, mm-hmm. a movie that I managed to avoid because...
you are a wise and discerning person.
Because I'm a wise and discerning person, and because I heard what he had to say about it. But even there, what he tends to do, he's very much a Thomist. And so what Thomas always does is try to give as much credit as possible to the argument that he's about to destroy. Right. And so you'll hardly ever find anybody who's a more fair exponent of positions that he deeply disagrees with than Robert Barron. Mm-hmm. He'll give the devil his due. He really will try to do that. And so in his review of 2012, he makes the point that he had a theology professor one time who said that when Christianity had its great explosive schism in the 16th century, he said that the church didn't so much split as kind of explode. And what you got were big chunks of Christianity that flew up in the air and came down in random places, like giant shards of obsidian or something from a volcanic explosion. And so we still find all over in our culture these chunks of Christianity, but they're no longer related to each other in a coherent whole, except within the faith. And so you get, for example... you'll get eschatology, the belief that history is going somewhere, that there's a judgment that's coming, and that you know, our sins will one day be reckoned up, our virtues will one day be reckoned up. Except you get it in terms of things like belief in judgment coming to us through Mother Earth. We have sinned against the earth, and so the earth is going to wreak judgment against us by means of, you know, earthquakes, famines, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. But these are ideas that are separated from the Christian picture. And in 2012, what you got was a really aggressively hostile assault on Orthodox Christianity from the filmmakers, but coupled with this idea of ultimately of some kind of eschatological judgment. So every time the Christian... I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was... Well, and the fact that it was set in the year 2012, of course, placed the movie within a specific eschatological mythology, not that of the ancient Mayans, of course.
Right.
But the kind of Western New Age eschatology that looked at the ancient Mayan calendar, was it Mayan or Aztec? I don't remember.
Mayan, I think.
Mayan, okay. Yeah. And saw that as some kind of dire Mesoamerican insight into the end of the world, which is, of course, right. It's a concept that's probably larger than Christianity, but which is certainly a very Christian idea.
Right.
But here placed into a New Age context.
Right.
And I think given a realization, I wouldn't myself call it hostile to Christianity, but I would call it profoundly secular. And in the end, well, you haven't seen it, right?
Well, I haven't seen it, but
I saw it and you haven't.
Okay, but his description of it, I mean, I have seen the clips that he's referring to.
Yes.
So, you know, you've got all the cardinals and bishops praying
right.
in the Sistine Chapel, and right. then some terrible earthquake strikes, and there's this big crack that develops in the ceiling, and the crack goes yes. right between the finger right. of God and the hand of Adam.
That
you know?
Is true.
And then the dome of St. Peter's, like, falls off and rolls across St. Peter's Square and crushes all the praying Catholics. I would call that an image of hostility to the faith. Yeah.
maybe there's some hostility there, but I could, in theory, I could see a Christian filmmaker making some of those same images. What gives me more of a problem than that are two other things. First of all, a remnant of humanity does survive, as you know. It's not going to, even Roland Emmerich is not going to wipe out everybody in the world, although he's going to get closer than any other mainstream filmmaker working today.
So
at the end, we see this remnant of humanity emerging from an ark, from one of a number of arcs that has saved the world, or has saved, saved a remnant. And we see representatives of, I guess maybe Shinto or Buddhism or something getting off of the ark. It's been a number of years, so I don't remember specifically. But we don't see any Catholics or Orthodox. We don't see any clergy. And this is, you know, from our point of view, there's nothing inherently impossible about St. Peter's, you know, being destroyed and burning to the ground. Unlike the Muslim Kaaba, which in Mecca, which he was originally going to show being destroyed, but in the end he decided that a fatwa was probably not worth it. We can deal with the loss of real estate, but the church cannot go on without bishops. And if he's going to specifically visually show us bishops being destroyed, all these images of Christianity being destroyed, he can give us toss us a bone and throw us a couple bishops at the end. And then, of course, you do have a worldwide cataclysmal flood, which comes as close to violating what Christians have always believed about the story in Genesis as anything I can imagine.
Yeah. Hey, listen, we're up against a break, but we'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Connecting the Dots here on listener-supported Real Life Radio. This is Mark Shea, and I'm talking to my good friend, Mr. Steve Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots here on listener-supported Real Life Radio. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today talking with my good friend, Stephen Gradonis. Just a word about being listener-supported. There's nobody that keeps Catholic Radio on the air but you. No Chubb Corporation, no federal dollars at all support Catholic Radio. It's just listeners like you, generous listeners like you, who keep us on the air. So give us a call at 1-855-949-1380, either to make a donation, or if you want, you can talk with me and Stephen Gradonis. We'd be happy to chat with you about whatever your favorite movies are. You can also go to our website, realliferadio.com, and check out the Care to Share program. Help keep Catholic Radio on the air and give back to your community. Stephen, have you seen any good movies lately?
Yes, I have.
How about that? It's like you're a film reviewer or something. You see a lot of movies, I'm told.
Not as many these days as I would like. I do have to spend some time in my diaconal studies and both going to class and then studying for tests and writing papers and stuff like that. But when I get a chance to, I do watch movies, and on occasion, they are good.
That's good.
Yes. And the film I want to talk about today, which just came out on Blu-ray and DVD, and which is also available on a range of streaming services, is my number 7 film of 2014 and my favorite animated film, my favorite family film of 2014. It's called Song of the Sea. It was nominated for a Best Animated Feature Academy Award. And it is directed by Tom Moore, the co-founder of the Irish animation house Cartoon Saloon, which is also responsible for the 2009 Oscar-nominated animated feature The Secret of Kells, which I also very much enjoyed.
Cool. Well, talk about it a little bit. I've seen The Secret of Kells. It's, by the way, if you guys out there in Radio Land have Netflix, You can see The Secret of Kells because it's right there for free streaming. And it's really good. What I love about it is that it has a very distinctly Irish flair for storytelling, and the Irish love of legend that goes into it. And it's the animation is done almost in the style of the art of the Book of Kells.
Right. It's not exactly like. I don't know if anything would be exactly like, but it definitely gives a kind of a vibe or a feel of being an Irish illuminated manuscript come to life. It's very graphical. It is defiantly two-dimensional in its approach to animation. We're used to computerized computer animation that has a very 3D look to it, a very sculpted round look as if of object in real space. And Song of the Sea, like The Secret of Kells, goes 180 degrees in the other direction. This is art that really flaunts its origins on two-dimensional pieces of paper and on computer screens.
Okay.
And that really works very well for The Secret of Kells, which is a story set in the turn of the from the 8th to the 9th centuries in Ireland, in the Irish monastic tradition.
Right.
Where a group of monks are in fact working on the Book of Kells, which is a fantastically decorated and adorned book of the Gospels. And the monks exist as they're kind of a young upstart faith in Ireland, in which there is this older presence of fairies and elves and dark gods and magic. And you know that world is passing away and the Christian world is really coming to the fore. And a recurring theme in the film is the idea of turning darkness into light. Although the movie does have sympathy for one winsome woodland sprite named Ashlyn. So the new film is a modern day story. It's set in the late 20th century, perhaps the mid 1980s or so. Judging from some of the technology we see in the film, like the Walkman that the young hero plays at one point.
Okay.
And so it's a way, it's a world that is profoundly linked to the world of The Secret of Kells, because by this point, Irish Christianity has become an ancient presence, a very well-established presence on the Emerald Isle. But it also continues to coexist with this lingering memory of fairies and elves. So once again, you have a story in which there is an imaginative young boy and a magical girl. And as they walk through their world, they might go walk past a Gothic cathedral with a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And 60 seconds later, they might come across an Irish fairy fort, a mound wherein are thought to dwell the creatures called the Dina Shi, or the people of the mound, a type of fairy or elven creature. And we might see statues of the Dina Shi. And if it's Halloween, which it is in the movie, throughout most of the Song of the Sea, we might actually meet the Dina Shi themselves. So.
Okay.
I know that your son Luke is a big fan, as I am, of Studio Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki from Japan's greatest animator and one of the greatest animators of all time. And you know, there's a real kinship between this film, Song of the Sea, and the films of Hayao Miyazaki. You can see it in a number of different ways. One thing is that in Song of the Sea there is a matter-of-fact cultural background of religious artifacts and spiritual artifacts, the churches, the statues, the fairy forts. There's a holy well, which plays a very important role in the film. This is something that the Irish landscape is dotted with hundreds of these holy wells that we can talk about a little later. And it's like the characters in My Neighbor Totoro being caught in the rainstorm and dashing into a Japanese Buddhist shrine in order to get out of the rain. Our hero and heroine, Ben and Saoirse, dash into this holy well in order to get out of the rain. And it's just part of the cultural landscape. Mm-hmm. And then also the other thing that I find so such a relief about a film like Song of the Sea is that it has this leisurely, unrushed pace where even my favorite Hollywood animated films, the better ones like Big Hero 6, which we've talked about on this show, and the Lego Movie, which are so inventive and have such interesting things to talk about, at the same time, they just have this frantic restlessness. The banter and the dialogue and the jokes and the action never stop. It's boom, 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 rush from one thing to another. It's like attention deficit disorder style filmmaking. And there's no time to catch your breath. There's no time to create a sense of wonder or mystery or to savor silence and beauty. Mm-hmm. And Miyazaki, as I'm sure you know, he's 180 degrees the other way. He, like Tolkien, there is something in the Japanese sensibility that allows for quiet, somber sadness and an openness to nostalgia and an openness to a sense of loss and to mystery and to wonder. And we have all of that in Song of the Sea as well. And that is what makes it my favorite family film of 2014.
Well, that's great. You know, I think one of the things that the Irish, who have lost so much, have preserved for us in the West, Americans really don't believe in a sense of loss. We're in a lot of ways, we're a people without a past. We don't really believe in history. We believe in the future. Tomorrow is always going to be better than today. That's
very well put.
Yeah, it's a very deeply American thing. You know, I remember one time we homeschooled our eldest son, and I went to get him from, he was over at another house with a number of homeschool kids and their moms, and I went to get him one day, and one of the women who was there, she is a convert to Orthodoxy. Her husband was in fact an Orthodox priest. He died a few years ago, and she was lamenting because she was having a terrible time finding a decent history textbook. She had ordered a history textbook from a publisher she knew nothing about, Bob Jones University. Bob Jones University is like, puts the fun in fundamentalism, right? So they sent her this textbook, and she opens it. The first thing that her eyes fall on is a picture of an Orthodox priest baptizing a baby, and the caption on it was something like, you know, paganized fake Christians, you know, performing magical rituals on their children, right? She's like, I'm not going to give this to my kids. So she boxed it up and sent it home. So she was lamenting trying to find this a decent textbook. So as it happened, I had a friend who was visiting from Britain, and we got invited to a salmon bake over at her parish, her Orthodox parish. So we took my friend, his name was Graham, and we went to the salmon bake, and I saw the woman, and her name was Miriam. And I said, Miriam, I heard you complaining about difficulty finding a decent textbook. I just wanted you to know that there's going to be a Catholic homeschool conference happening up in Everett, not far from where we live. And you should be able to find a textbook there that won't trample all over the sensibilities of the Orthodox. And she looked at me and she says, well, you Catholics have trampled all over the Orthodox. What about the sack of Constantinople in 1204?
Yes.
And I was like, I'm sorry we sacked your city. This was a conversation
I mean, it was really, really bad.
It was bad, you know, but it was 1204. I mean, so I turned to my friend Graham.
With a profound sense of history.
Right. And I turned to my friend Graham as we were leaving, and I said, I just want you to know I've really put the burning of the White House behind us. So we'll talk about this sense of history as we when we come back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots here on Real Life Radio. Welcome back to Connecting the Dots here on listener-supported Real Life Radio. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're talking today with Stephen Gradonis, who has just seen a fine follow-up to a really, really wonderful animated film that I just saw recently. The film that I saw is called The Secret of Kells, and it's about medieval Irish monks and their attempts to preserve civilization against the Northmen, as well as I like the way that the Northmen are portrayed. They're just these dark, stolid, terrifying figures. The only thing they know how to say is gold. That's
yeah. I mean, they're basically they're basically orcs.
Yeah, they're orcs. They're just these terrifying And they occupied that place in the imagination of the Middle Ages. You know, one of the most famous prayers to come down from that time, from the English and Irish church, was "From the fury of the Northmen, deliver us, O Lord." Not nice people. But the film that you have just seen, which is made by the people who made The Secret of Kells, is Song of the Sea. And you were saying before we went to the break, we were talking about the fact that the Irish have preserved a sense of loss and of tragedy that Americans don't believe in, with the exception of Death of a Salesman. I can't think of any great American tragedies.
That's an interesting insight.
Yeah, and it's significant that our form of tragedy would be Death of a Salesman. We want our stories to have happy endings, and by gum, we'll get them. No matter what. If we kill Spock off, we're going to bring him back. You
know? And I think that of course that desire for eucatastrophe is something that we find in cultures that have a more tragic perspective than we do, and it is something that we get to a certain extent. I think it really the movie wants to have a happier ending than it really does in The Secret of Kells, and definitely in Song of the Sea, although it is a movie that ends with a sort of a Tolkien-esque happiness blended with sadness, because there are these fair folk, these fairy creatures, but they are leaving Middle Earth in a sense, even though the story is set in the 1980s. So, but I think that it's interesting that both of these films play with the Irish heritage of Catholicism and of mythology. Mm-hmm. And of the two, I think that I really prefer the approach of Song of the Sea. Now I'm a big fan of The Secret of Kells. I think it's visually gorgeous, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. But I feel like the movie, somewhat in the way that George Lucas does in Star Wars when he tries to appropriate some of Tolkien's Christian elements without really understanding them, like the idea that the wizard that falls into darkness is going to come back more powerful than before. But where Tolkien had that Catholic background of the resurrection informing that idea, Lucas doesn't, and so Ben Kenobi doesn't come back more powerful. Mm-hmm. I think that The Secret of Kells somewhat shortchanges the Christian world in relation to Ireland's lingering paganism. In that film, we see the fairy world being depicted as magical and powerful and living in a very matter-of-fact way. Christianity, by contrast, is limited and mundane.
And walled in.
And walled in. Yes.
Yeah.
So we meet spirits in the Irish countryside that are terrifying and that are charming. We meet the bloodthirsty god Crom Croc, and then also Ashlyn, this sprite. But we don't see anything like we find in Irish folklore regarding the extravagant miracles of the saints, for instance. We hear stories that lean in that direction, but it turns out to not have a basis in the way that the magical stuff does. That's mitigated in some ways. We can see Christianity being vindicated over paganism in certain ways in The Secret of Kells. But on an imaginative level, there's a kind of an imbalance there. Mm-hmm. I like the approach in Song of the Sea better. In Song of the Sea, we also have Christianity and mythology coexisting side by side, but they aren't pitted against each other in the same way. And, excuse me, while it's true that once again we have a story in which the revelation of power is connected with Ireland's mythic past rather than its religious past, there's much more of a sense of that this is just the story that this particular movie is telling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the story is set on Halloween, and in the magical Ireland of this film, where it seems like everything is enchanted, I could almost believe that the next day, on All Saints Day, we could watch a completely different story in which there's a revelation regarding all of the churches and statues of the Blessed Virgin and things that we've seen in the film.
Okay.
So I think that there's a kind of a happier balance of these two elements of the Irish heritage in Song of the Sea, as much as I like and appreciate The Secret of Kells.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Ireland is, sadly, it's become profoundly post-Christian in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And of course, it's you know, as Chesterton never actually said, but never let the truth stand in the way of a good story. So I'm going to go ahead and I'll say it's a Chestertonian aphorism to say that when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And you certainly see that in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So you get, you know, I went to the Hill of Tara, which is ground zero for Irish Catholicism. It's where St. Patrick met the High King and evangelized him, proceeded to evangelize the entire island of Ireland. Patrick's evangelization of Ireland is unique in antiquity because it's the only major evangelization campaign that produced no martyrs. There was no bloodshed in Ireland as it became Christian. Patrick didn't get killed. Nobody got killed. And the hill at Tara is where this all happened because it's where the High King had his throne because it had this commanding view of 365 degrees. It was there that it was to the hill of on the hill of Slane to the south that Patrick lit the first Paschal fire. That's where we get the Paschal fire was Patrick invented it. And he invented it as a thumb in the eye to the Druids. The Druids, the law at that time in Ireland was nobody can build a fire on this particular holy night. Well, it happened to fall on the Easter Vigil. And so Patrick deliberately lit a fire because he knew it would draw the attention of the Druids and they would haul him before the High King and that would be his chance. And so when you go to the Hill of Tara today, there's a big statue of Patrick and there's a, you know, all of that. But at the foot of the hill is, you know, some new age shop that sells crystals and, you know, gewgaws, you know, so that you can summon your spirit guide or do whatever, you know. They built a highway past it a while back. And the big controversy in Ireland was that the pagans were upset because the freeway or the whatever road they were building was crossing ley lines. Ley lines are supposed to be some kind of magical coordinates that draw down important magical forces or something like this. And so you get this in Ireland coupled with a really aggressive secularism. That's deeply hostile to the faith, particularly hostile to the faith. But then you get a film like this that just kind of comes up out of the Irish soul. And I find that remarkable, that as the culture is trying to dismantle its Christian heritage, it keeps, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it keeps running across these big chunks of the Christian faith that are embedded in the landscape. And good artists somehow or other sense that these things are important, even if their personal ideology may forbid them to honor the Catholic faith in some way.
Right. And I have no idea where Tom Moore is coming from, but it's certainly true that in his films, and he said this in interviews, that he is deliberately and consciously exploring his Irish heritage and trying to figure out his relationship to it in these films. Hmm. And I think it's important, and I think it's valuable that he sees something like the Holy Well in Song of the Sea as being part of that heritage. That this Holy Well, which we see in the film, is a remarkable place. It's a well that may once have been used as a place of pagan spirituality. It's got this big hawthorn tree attached to it, and it's been used by Christians for centuries. And it's domed over, and on the inside, it's gorgeous. There are these towering statues of Mary. There are all of these images of Jesus and Mary and the saints. There are votive candles that are lit, so people are actually visiting this and lighting candles, flowers hanging from the roof, and all of these icons of prayer that people have left, things like crutches and eyeglasses. There are strips of cloth tied to the tree. The tree is what the Irish call a rag tree, meaning that you tie a piece of cloth to it and you hope to access the power of the Holy Well on behalf of the person whose clothing it is. And it offers Ben and Saoirse respite from the rainstorm. And, you know, there's a scene of Ben kind of looking up at the statue of Mary with her arms outstretched, like she's welcoming him to her home. It's really nice.
Well, that's cool. And it's, you know, I could go into a whole, you know, the biblical theology of wells. Wells in the Old Testament are often associated with marriage and fertility. So Abraham. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about this after the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots here on listener-supported Real Life Radio. I'm your host, Mark Shabe, talking to Steve Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this. And we're back on Connecting the Dots. You're listening to me, Mark Shea, and my good friend, Mr. Stephen Gradonis, here on Real Life Radio. We've been talking about The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea. If you've got a movie you want to talk about, give us a call at 1-855-949-1380. 1-855-949-1380. Join the conversation. You're welcome to do it. Before we went to the break, you were talking about the image of this holy well in Song of the Sea, and one of the things that it's interesting to notice is that there's like a theology of wells that keeps popping up in the New Testament, or Old Testament and New Testament.
Indeed,
and they're always connected. It's always connected with life and fertility. So Abraham sends his servant to go find a wife for his son Isaac. And he stops at a well, and there he meets Rebecca. Dun, 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 Moses kills the Egyptian. He flees Egypt, goes to the land of Midian, stops at a well, and there he meets Zipporah. Dun, 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 Hagar is exiled, and it looks like she's about to die. And more importantly, it looks like her son Ishmael is about to die. The one of the heirs of Abraham suddenly, finds a well. It's called Beersheba. The well is still there. Beersheba is still there. So that line of life continues. And what you find is when you get to the New Testament, exactly the same themes are being played. So Jesus in the Gospel of John performs his first miracle, the first of his miracles, which doesn't mean first numerically so much as archetypal. If you want to understand what John is saying, is that if you want to understand all the other miracles and signs that Jesus performs in his gospel, you have to get this one first, because this is the key to understanding all the rest of them. And it's the miracle, it's the wedding at Cana, where he turns water into wine. So what is John getting at there? Well, what John's getting at is that Jesus is the real bridegroom. I'm not going all Dan Brown here on us. I'm not saying that this is Jesus's marriage and he's getting married to Mary Magdalene. That's not what we're talking about. But what John means is that Jesus is the great cosmic bridegroom, and his bride is the church. How do I know that? Because I know this ancient mystical Catholic practice called turning the page in my Bible. And when you do that, you find that you're at an interview with John the Baptist. A delegation has come out to talk to John the Baptist, and they ask him, "Who are you?" And John says, "I'm not the bridegroom. Jesus, over there in chapter 2, he's the bridegroom." And when you turn the page again, you find yourself in Samaria, and Jesus is talking to a woman at a well.
Yes.
And their whole conversation is suffused with this nuptial subtext. It's all about marriage. So he talks to her and he says, at one level he's talking to her and she's like the Elizabeth Taylor of the ancient world. So she's already had 5 husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband, says Jesus. But what we have to understand is that this whole conversation is being conducted very likely in Aramaic. And if you know the background of the Samaritan people, which is what this woman was, what you discover is that the Samaritan people are the product of what we today call ethnic cleansing. What had happened was the nation of Israel that had lived where Samaria was had been deported by the Assyrians 7 centuries before. And then the Assyrians brought in 5 different nations to live in that area, along with the straggling remnants of Israel. And the idea was just like today: here, you guys fight amongst yourselves, and then we don't have to think about you, said the Assyrians. Well, each one of those nations that came into that area brought with them their own cultic deity called a Baal. It was a fertility deity. And Baal is a fascinating word because it means Lord and husband.
Yes.
So when Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman and he says, "You've already had 5 husbands, and the one that you're with now is not your husband," who is the one she's with now? I mean, right now. Well, it's Jesus. Indeed. So what you've got is the bridegroom is proposing marriage at a well to Samaria, because the bridegroom is God. And we see the prophets speaking this way about the relationship between Israel and God all the time. He's described as the bridegroom. Israel is the bride. And so there's all this nuptial language. And we miss that if we don't know the background of this conversation. So anyway, there's your Bible lesson for the day.
And if you want to see the Holy Well in Song of the Sea, you can go to decentfilms.com, and it's right there on the homepage.
Oh, cool. Cool. Yeah. Hey, you were going to tell a story about something that happened to you one time, and I want to get this before we go off the air. So.
Oh, well, you had mentioned the story about talking to you were with your British friends, and you were talking to this Orthodox friend, and suddenly she was lacing into you about the sack of Constantinople, and your British friend just kind of faded into the woodwork.
Right.
And that reminded me of a story having to do with my friend Noel. Now, in order to understand the story, you need to know a little bit about Noel, and I like to start with Noel by asking you to think of C-3PO. Now, my friend Noel wasn't exactly like C-3PO, but he had a heritage that he had British. He had some English in him. One of his parents was Irish and the other was English. And he was like the epitome in certain respects of that Twitter feed, "Very British Problems." He was very, very polite, very proper, a little nervous, a little diffident, very neat. Very concerned about propriety. He was enormously important to me and to Suzanne in coming to really receive our Catholic identity as a personal and cultural thing. We had been, like many people, we were intellectual converts. He had been a convert from Anglicanism for 10 years, and he really helped to plug us into Catholicism as a lived reality. Well, one day he was coming by our apartment and he had a friend with him, and this made him intensely nervous because here they were, two people dropping in unexpectedly. And he hadn't called ahead, and this was in the day before everybody carried cell phones.
Not so the done thing.
Right, exactly. So he's walking up to the door, and Noel happens to have relatives who are Jehovah's Witnesses. And so he's feeling a little bit like a Jehovah's Witness. Two people coming to a door unsolicited, knocking on the door. And so he decides to try to diffuse the tension with a joke. So he rings the doorbell and I open the door and he says, "Hi, we're from your local Kingdom Hall and we'd like to talk to you about living forever in paradise on earth." And he laughs nervously. I can't even tell you the profound sense of intellectual disconnect that I was experiencing at this moment. For reason, I thought, is he making a joke? But it's not, he wouldn't make that joke. And I couldn't. And finally, after about what seemed to me like a 30 seconds of just standing there, I realized that I was on the chasm of this immense coincidence. And all I could say to him was, "Don't joke." And I turned away from the door and I sat back down in my living room and went back to the conversation with the Jehovah's Witness on my couch. And Noel stood there at the door like an Indian, like a wooden Indian in a shop window for the rest of the. Finally, this guy gets up to leave, and as he goes out the door, he shakes Noel's head and he says, "Oh, it's always great to meet someone from another Kingdom Hall." And Noel's like, "Yes, yes." As soon as the door is closed, he dissolves onto the carpet with this cri de coeur, this absolute cry of anguish.
"I'm so sorry."
One of the most amazing things that has ever happened to me.
That is so great. That's just magnificent. Wow. I haven't had anything like that happen to me. I don't know what to say. Yeah, when Miriam lit into me about the sack of Constantinople, that was when I was so acutely aware of the vast gulf between the historical memory of the Orthodox and me, Mr. Average American, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what struck me. You know, that was why it was so funny when I turned to, you know, because for us, literally, you know, when I turned to Graham and said, "I've really put the burning of the White House behind me," he was like, "Okay, you know, for an American, that's like ancient history, right? Why? I mean, it's like the Beatles are ancient history for us, you know." But hey, listen, Steve, I wanna thank you so much for being on the show. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots here on Real Life Radio with Mark Shea and Stephen Gerdanis. I will be back on Monday, and I will see you then. Goodbye.